Welcome to Activation Energy by the Chemical Angel Network. I'm your host, Selma Duhovich. In this episode, I have a co-host, Halima Kashif, who is a second-year master's student in the Department of Chemistry at my alma mater, UCLA. I have been asked many times to broaden the scope of this podcast, so due to popular demand, the current episode marks the beginning of an exploration of deep technologies. Halima and I speak with Dr. Ben Schrag, the program director and policy liaison at the National Science Foundation, about deep tech and how government agencies help advance innovation. Hi, Ben. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start from the beginning. Could you please walk us through your career path? You have a PhD in physics from Brown. How did you end up mobilizing taxpayers' money to finance innovation?
I think my career path was kind of a traditional STEM career path up until toward the end of my grad student career. I always liked science and math and wanted to study either math or physics since I can remember. And so my plan was to get a PhD and then do research somewhere, either academia or industry. And then the research that I was doing as part of my grad school work at Brown, it ended up having kind of this implication for potentially, you know, a new product, a new industry impact, something where the science could actually create, you know, impact in the commercial market. It was a totally random occurrence. We didn't intend to do that when we set out to do the research, but like most discovery or much of discovery, you don't know where it's going to go. And so we ended up basically, when I was kind of getting ready to graduate, starting a company with my graduate advisor and one of my colleagues. And so I spent the 7 years after my PhD and part of the last year of my PhD working on this startup. And it was a semiconductor equipment hardware startup. And so I was interested in first at kind of the science and how to make the actual product work. But as I went through the process of the startup experience, I got very interested and passionate and curious about how technology actually gets out into the market and the challenges there. And that kind of captured my attention. And so by the time my startup journey was coming to an end, I wanted to see if I could kind of stay in that place instead of kind of going back to science, basic science, to figure out if I could help keep thinking and keep helping people with this idea of getting science into the marketplace. And so after my startup, I was lucky enough to come to the National Science Foundation, where I've been ever since.
Thank you. And what is NSF's mandate with respect to commercialization of scientific innovation?
So, the National Science Foundation, for those who don't know, is a federal agency. It's a funding agency primarily, meaning that most of what we do is decide how to allocate funding. And, you know, most of the NSF, as the name indicates, is about basic science. And so most of the funding we provide is for people who are just trying to understand the world. So these are astronomers, biologists, psychologists, geologists, mathematicians, and they're just trying to do curiosity-driven research with not necessarily any practical or commercial impact in mind. So NSF's main mandate is to promote the progress of science. Obviously, one of the biggest ways that science actually impacts the world is when it's turned and productized into new processes, new services, and things like that. And so there are parts of NSF, which includes where I sit, where the funding is not necessarily for the basic science, but for trying to take the next step after the discovery into, how do you get this into the hands of the taxpayer? And so there is actually an entire new directorate at NSF, which is, it's very rare. We don't create new directorates. It's like it's a big piece of the organization, which is now about a year old, called Technology, Innovation, and Partnerships. And that directorate was created, as you mentioned, Halima, to kind of have a home for all the innovation programs, because we've always had a number of programs that serve kind of the innovation approach, but we haven't had kind of an overall structure for them to sit. And so our mandate really is to try to help folks take that next step past science, past engineering, and to try to get them started on whatever the next step is for that new discovery, whether it be a startup company, or whether it be an open source project, or whether it be an entrepreneurial journey of some kind, or maybe even a translation to a large industrial partner. So that's kind of how that's kind of the early stage of the commercialization's journey is typically where we sit.
Thank you. And then with that being said, what are the SBIR and STTR programs, the differences between the two and their phases?
Sure. So SBIR is Small Business Innovation Research. STTR is Small Business Technology Transfer. So these are programs that are congressionally mandated, and so they exist across the entire federal government. So any federal agency that does a significant amount of research is required to take a piece of that funding and put it into these two programs or one of these two programs. And again, as the names suggest, the goal here is that these are funding programs, non-dilutive funding, to help small businesses take new technology out of the lab and into the marketplace. And so the funding is for research and development in order to kind of prove out the new product or service, because even after the discovery is made, as folks probably know, the product or service that builds on the discovery is still very uncertain, very unproven. Nobody knows if it's quite going to work the way it needs to work. So the funding in our program is intended to help small businesses to get across that gap, basically. It is a 2 or 3 phase program, depending on how you look at it. The phases, basically, the first phase is kind of like a feasibility, so proving that something may actually work if you're able to show that eventually we can get this product to work. And then phase two is kind of building toward a prototype, or in some cases even beyond a prototype, depending on how fast things go, basically. And then the funding behind the phases is typically, it varies a little bit, but it's typically about $250,000 for phase one, and somewhere on the order of $1 million for phase two, and depending on, again, the agency. But there's 11 different agencies, and the National Science Foundation is one of those. We actually created the SBR program back in the 70s and before Congress mandated it, and so we're very proud that it's gone kind of, not global, but across the government in the way it has.
What was the motivation behind creating SBIR and SDTR programs in the first place?
Yeah, so I think many times the origin story of a lot of innovation programs is kind of economic insecurity. And so in the 70s, I didn't know this, I was a kid, but there was economic stagflation. There was a lot of concern about economic competitiveness of the country. And then, of course, there was also a lot of concern about foreign competitors. There's a big concern about, say, Japan in the 80s. Congress was very worried about us losing our economic edge. And so that was obviously one of the fuels that helped push this from an NSF pilot program into a congressionally mandated program. But the basic origin was that, the federal government, especially since World War II, has funded lots of research. And historically, much of that research has been successfully completed, it's been published, but not a lot of it has actually made the transition to impacting people in the world. So the idea was, how do we find a better way to take all that great science that the government is funding and get more of it out into to impact people? And so there's a couple things that were done in order for Congress to try to help that happen. One of them was mandating this SBIR program, which NSF had created to try to, again, solve this problem about translation of the technology. The other thing was the Bayh-Dole Act, which actually then changed how the intellectual property of government research was disposed. So before 1982, if the government paid for certain research and it developed some kind of intellectual property, the government owned that intellectual property. And of course, the government is not position to be able to actually take a new patent to market. And so the idea was that Bayh-Dole made it so that the entity that the government funded to do the research then from then on owned that intellectual property. And so that gave these small businesses and universities the ownership of that IP and the ability to then take it forward into the market. So that was all, again, just kind of a broad macroeconomic concern about competitiveness that drove some of the changes that allowed this program to spring into existence.
Economic advancement drives everything, doesn't it? You touched upon it a bit, but can you elaborate on the type of inventions that these programs fund?
Yeah, so we are looking for very risky, potentially disruptive new technologies across the spectrum of technology. The idea being that we're trying to let our program fit into a gap in the external private ecosystem. And one of the big places where the private sector typically has a hard time supporting new products is when they are technically difficult, technically challenging and risky, and maybe therefore have a long timeline to market or maybe a lot of capital requirements. And so we try to fund the game-changing, disruptive, high-risk, high-impact technologies. And we try to do that across every area where there is kind of the possibility for new science-based products and services to exist. So we fund from IT and pharmaceuticals to robotics, chemical technologies, new materials, various kinds of software, medical device, I said, biotechnology, anything that basically has that core technical piece that could potentially create this disruptive and unfairly competitive product in the market. So we try to really hit early stages of the company and early stage of the technology development cycle. That's our sweet spot.
You use the word disruptive. What does that mean from where you stand? How do you define it?
Yeah, so there's a couple ways to look at that. This is one of the tricky things, right? So disruptive is basically something where if it's successful in the market, it's going to really just change the entire landscape of the competitive situation in the market. And so we talk about something that's 10 times better and not 10% better than what's out there now. So some examples of disruptive would be laser eye surgery. You know, before laser eye surgery, you used a scalpel to do eye surgery. Using a laser is just a totally different approach. And you can imagine once you're using a laser, like everything can change about the way it works, you know, the customer's experience, the price, all those things are basically totally up in the air because you've got this totally new paradigm. So we're looking for those kinds of, and by the way, LASIK is one of the, Interlase was one of the companies we funded at the NSF in the 1990s. So I use that intentionally. But the idea there is that this technology is going to create this, this sea change in the market, which hopefully is for everybody's benefit, the customer and the user especially.
How many applications do these programs get annually?
So we have a few stages in our process. As far as the full proposal, which is probably the stage that people are most interested in, we typically receive about 2,000 to 3,000 phase one full proposals per year. We typically fund between 10 and 20% of those. And so the average number of new phase one companies we fund is about 300, 350, something like that per year. And then about 40 to 50% of those go on to phase two, meaning that we fund something like 100 or 150 phase twos per year. So our portfolio, some of these are multi-year awards. And so our portfolio at any given time of companies that we're actively supporting is something like 700 to 800 companies.
Wow, that's a lot. I didn't realize that. So what are the criteria that you use to evaluate these applications?
So we use a hybrid of, there's two things that are kind of combining in the projects that we fund. One is it's a startup company. And so this kind of an investment perspective is we borrow a lot of the best practices from the early stage investment sector. We're looking very heavily at the team, especially the kind of intangibles of the founders. And we're looking at early market traction, you know, and that's usually not, a product to sell yet, but there's hopefully a sense of some feedback from the market that there's a need to meet. And obviously then later on the process, we're looking at some of the things that investors also look at, which is understanding the size of the market, the margins, you know, the economics behind it, and also the ability of the team to scale, that sort of thing. So that's one piece, the kind of startup investment angle. The other angle we look at is that this is unknown science. There's a big bet here you're putting on being able to take the science and take it down from this idea to something that works repeatedly, you know, as a proven product. And so that on that side, we take the best practices of the scientific community, which is external deep technical peer review. So we bring in external experts who are deep in the technology or scientific area that's relevant to the development of the product. We get advice from them and get them to give feedback to our applicants and have them kick the tires of the science and the R&D plan that we're gonna pay for. Then we have program directors who kind of span those two startup/scientific worlds who take all that in, and then they may do their own diligence, and then they make the funding recommendations. So that's kind of the thumbnail about how the review process works.
Can we go deeper into this decision-making process? So you had invited me previously to participate as a reviewer, which was eye-opening, but I'm wondering if you can paint a more holistic picture of the three decision-makers that you just mentioned and how they think about what gets funded.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, as far as the folks who are actually touching an application, you know, there's really kind of three main stakeholders there. One is the external reviewers. You mentioned, Selma, that you have participated in that role. You know, the NSF is a scientific agency, and we have lots and lots of scientists who are willing to come and give us advice. And so, we recruit thousands of scientists each year to look at applications and give us their advice on that. And so the reviewers basically are experts brought in with very specific either technical or commercial skill sets, or maybe a combination. I mean, Selma, you're a great example. You have a technical background and a startup background. That's like a perfect match for, you know, the kind of things we're looking at. Some people have either one or the other. Some people have both. And then the second stakeholder is the program director. I'm one of 12, and we actually invite these reviewers. We give them direction. We discuss with them. We try to summarize their feedback and kind of consolidate it all together. And we are the ones who make a recommendation to the National Science Foundation, say we think this is something worth funding. We write that up, we document it, we make our arguments. And then our leadership, the NSF leadership and the NSF grants apparatus, are the third stakeholder. And they basically will review the recommendation, sometimes push back, sometimes ask questions, kick the tires for compliance and policy and all those pieces, make sure we're following all the rules. And then they will actually process our recommendation into a new award, a funding award.
Could you please share and highlight some success stories of companies that have benefited from the SBIR program and how they have made a significant impact?
Sure. Yeah. So I think let me share a few examples from different lanes of success, let's say. So one company that got support from us when they were, I think, less than 12 employees was Qualcomm. That's obviously a big public standard brand name company that built their initial operations on this new communications technology, right? And, you know, Qualcomm chips are on everybody's phone. So that's, we hear a lot about that. That's an example we cite just because there's a huge economic impact there. So that's a fairly easy to understand example. I mentioned laser eye surgery. That's kind of an example that shows, I think, the nature of a technical disruption that people can kind of understand as taxpayers. Let me give two more examples from more recently. And one of the things that's tricky about our program is that these technologies take years to come to market. And every company takes longer these days to go public, right? So the companies that the public hears about these days are ones that we funded in 2005 or 2010, right? It takes a long time. So there's a lot of emerging success stories just take. And the bigger success story, honestly, sometimes the longer it takes for our program. So there's a number of companies that we funded in about the last 10 or 15 years. I think there's four of them that all have actually successfully brought new aviation fuels to market based on no petrochemical sources. So basically making aviation fuels, in most cases, from CO2. So the idea that you're now able to create a fuel that could replace traditional jet fuel that is not based on hydrocarbons at all. That's based on hydrocarbons, not based on petroleum. So basically it's renewable and sustainable way to power aviation. So there's a company, there's a couple companies that these are all for public. They all publicly announced at least $1 million commitments from airlines to buy their fuels. One company is called 12. They're doing an electrochemical synthesis. There's a company called Dimensional Energy. Again, different technology, but the same idea of CO2 in, fuel out. And there's a couple others that there's one called Gevo and there's another one called Air Company. And so these are all four different, totally different technologies that actually ended up. And all of a sudden now the aviation industry is very open to the new sustainable fuels. And these companies have been working for years and they were in the right place at the right time. And so now they're going to start to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions of the aviation industry, hopefully by selling these renewable fuels. So that's kind of a very recent example of like something that burst into the path. The other company I wanted to talk about, because again, these are all big multi-million or billion-dollar markets. At the NSF, you know, we obviously want our companies to be commercially successful, but we have a willingness to be able to take our returns, so to speak. We're not actually an investor. We don't technically have returns, but we're looking at impacts. We're willing to take our impacts in non-economic terms. And so there's a company I wanted to mention that was started by an undergraduate at Carnegie Mellon. Her name was Emily Kennedy. And she had, I think, traveled somewhere in Eastern Europe and actually seen sex trafficking. Someone pointed out to her that it was happening kind of outside the car she was in. So she kind of had always wanted to figure out a way to help stop that. And so when she eventually became a senior undergraduate at Carnegie Mellon, she's studying computer science and she started a company called Marinus Analytics that uses artificial intelligence to basically do facial recognition that allows you to basically identify victims of sex trafficking from internet traffic. You know, back page type internet traffic. And so Marinus Analytics developed a software project called Traffic Jam that's now used by law enforcement agencies. And that's not a huge market, but there was a story that came out a few years ago where they had already basically confirmed that based on use of that tool, law enforcement agencies have been able to identify and save, I think it was 1,600 victims of sex trafficking based on that AI-based technology. So that's not necessarily a company that economically you'd have to invest in. It wouldn't make sense on the economic metrics, but it's obviously a gigantic, important impact that they have. And I think the NSF has a special ability to kind of fund those companies that are maybe not billion-dollar markets, but that are incredibly important to society.
Oh, that is an unexpected example. I did not see that coming.
But I dropped that on you. We didn't either, honestly. Again, this is the beauty of this job. They show up and they're like, oh, I never thought you could do that. That sounds like a fantastic idea. Let's give them funding to do it.
Can you highlight some success stories of chemical and material science companies that NSF has supported?
12, the company I just mentioned with this this new deal with Alaska Airlines to do sustainable aviation fuel. That is a chemical technology. That's a new chemical process in a kind of a cell that they've built. And that company has gotten support from many federal agencies and has raised like $50 million in venture to get to its point. They just built their first kind of pilot scale facility in Washington State. Another company I didn't mention that's a material science company is a company called Via Separations. This is a company that spun out of MIT about 6 years ago. They have a new membrane technology that's used for industrial separations. And so these are two brand new PhD students who started it. They were part of the NSF's ICOR program, which is something we can talk about if needed. And they based on the ICOR, they decided to create this company. And the company has a graphene oxide-based membrane that just makes certain separations much, much more efficient. And they've started to show it's able to do is that industrial separations like paper, pulp and paper, some of these heavy industries, dairy, a lot of times what they do if they want to separate some product from something else is they distill it, which essentially means you have to boil the whole thing off, right? You have to add energy until all the product evaporates, right? If you're actually able to use a membrane and filter it like a spaghetti strainer, the amount of energy is like 1% of what they're doing right now. And so this company is starting to introduce this again, a new, totally new way of doing things to these conservative industries. They have a pilot operation going. They've scaled from 2 employees to like, I think over 50 now. And not to keep talking about greenhouse gases, but the amount of energy that's emitted by these industrial separations is like over 10% of the global total. And so if you can start introducing filtration-based processes instead of distillation into these industries, you can save a huge amount of energy, which obviously also saves money for the customer. So Via Separations is a great example of a disruptive material technology that kind of makes a new process go. I'll give one more. There's a company called Biomason. This is actually a company not even started by a scientist. It was started by an architect named Ginger Dozier. And she wanted to make bio cement. She wanted to make cement that was grown instead of fired. And so she taught herself some biology and started growing cement and finally hit on a product that became this company called Biomason. And again, it's a way to create masonry, stone, bricks, things like that. But in a way that has no, right now you have to make a brick, you have to put it into a kiln, right? Just like you fire a clay pot, you have to put every brick you see has to get up to 1500 degrees or something. So she can basically grow these things in the dark at room temperature. So no energy is put into it. And again, the greenhouse gas and the cost implications are pretty significant. So Biomason is now again grown from a startup when we funded them to over 100 employees, and their products are starting to get into the market. So these are just kind of a range of different companies that we've supported. There's lots of other examples in different areas, but those are two that come to mind.
Thank you for that. How does the NSF SBIR program foster collaborations between small businesses, research institutions, and industry stakeholders?
Yeah, this is a great question. We obviously are, in some sense, always a partnership because we're only giving out money. We're not actually doing any of the work. So we need a partner to help do the work that we're paying for. So to some extent, everything we do is a partnership. But even in most of the cases, the companies we fund are also have a third partner, which is that a lot of them are connected to a research institution because a lot of the science comes from a university, for example. So I think the ways that we think about this are that we at NSF, we're what's called investigator driven, which is a little bit of an academic term, but what it means is that we give the people doing the work as much freedom as we can to propose what they think is the best thing to do. For some other agencies, they'd prefer to kind of tell them more specifically what they need because the agency may have a very specific need that they're trying to meet. But here at the NSF, we don't really have that. We're not the Defense Department. We don't have to help equip the warfighter directly, that sort of thing. So we're able to create this huge amount of flexibility to let these very smart individuals tell us what they think the most valuable use of their time is, or the most valuable use of their company. What's the best business model, that sort of thing. So creating a lot of flexibility and then trying to really hold them to very high standards of merit review, I think, is the kind of secret sauce. And once you're able to do that, create a lot of flexibility, and then evaluate them rigorously, you get really powerful partnerships.
Ben, the last thing that I want to cover is technological trends. So since you've started working at NSF, you have really had a front row seat to innovation. And I can't help but wonder what technological trends and patterns you have observed and you are observing right now. In a way, you see the technological future, and I'm wondering, what does 2030, 2040 look like from where you stand?
Yeah, so that's another great question. I think Both the scientific world and the startup world have trends, have trendy areas that come and go, right? So we've seen, for example, nanotechnology was all the rage in the 2000-2010 range. Then there was synthetic biology, and as you all know, blockchain, AI. There's been waves, and sometimes they're in science, and sometimes they're in the startup world, and sometimes they're in both. And so we've definitely seen that, and we've seen companies, we've seen application amounts surge in certain areas. So I think those come and go, and one of the things that I think is great about our program is that we try to be fairly agnostic to those trends, understanding that we don't have a thesis of a specific area. And so we've always tried to keep our topics, the different technologies we look at, we've always tried to keep them open, and we don't ever try to favor one over another, because it's just really hard to predict what's going to come next. And so we want to just keep the doors open as wide as possible. But I think to your question, I will say that one of the most encouraging trends that I've seen is that the amount of support and knowledge around building these deep science-based companies has just exploded, especially in the last 5 years. I mean, there's been a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of startup in the culture. Startup has kind of been in the culture for quite a while, but specifically this kind of science technology, deep technology-based startups, there's just a lot more unique, dedicated resources and learning and knowledge around those companies. And so I think to some extent, I tried to do this 20 years ago, and this, almost none of this stuff existed. And I made a lot of mistakes. I might've made them anyway, but again, I really wish I'd had a lot of these sources, because I might've actually avoided some of those pitfalls. But I would just say, if you're a scientist or engineer who thinks that what you're working on in the lab could form the basis for a company, it's the best time ever. And I think the US has got to be the best place ever, at least right now, to do that. And so I think it's an incredibly, incredibly positive environment, thermodynamic environment, for those kind of startups to germinate. So I think that's a trend we've seen, especially over the last 5 years, and just the amount of support and the amount of, and also the amount of investment, honestly, the private investors, a lot of them still necessarily aren't going to try to fund science, but a lot more are either directly focused on only funding these kind of science-based startups, or at least are putting some of their portfolio into them, compared to, say, when I got to NSF, where there was none of that. So, and that goes for places like Y Combinator and accelerators as well. So yeah, so that's my favorite trend. And then the other obviously recent trend that I'm sure you've talked about is that, you know, the capital markets go up and down. And so we had a bonanza of funding rounds in our portfolio, and then this year, in the last 6 months, it's gotten very difficult. And so I don't know what you can do about that, but I don't think that that will ever change. And so I would encourage entrepreneurs to always assume that whatever is happening will pass soon, will change. Yeah.
This was really insightful. Thank you so much again for taking the time to share your insight with us.
Thank you so much for having me.